Do you remember as we read in Matthew's Gospel, things happened. And someone said, why are these happening? Who's doing this? And he or they found the answer. We read in verse 54 at the end, fearing greatly, they said, truly, this was the Son of God. And they come to you and say, did you see that? Maybe talking about a glorious piece of art. Some remarkable needlework. Superb gardening. Magnificent engineering. An amazing passage of play on the sports field. I say, did you see that? But what happens next? I know if I could say these things, see them, say something like that of them, I know I would watch out for some more. If there's excellence, it's good to pursue it. And where would I find it? I would find it where the artist is. I would find it where I find the lace maker, the gardener, the engineer, the cricketer. Where do I find these wonderful things? I find them in the person who has made them. I see some work, I look for the worker. Where are we? I feel the time, it's 3 weeks since I was last preaching in this area. We are at the cross of Jesus. And what have we seen there? We have seen men doing as they please. Their work shows their character. The uncaring soldiers, the unrepentant Jews, if you will recall. Those last steps in a story that has unfolded through Jesus' life and ministry. Those apparently last steps in the story that's recorded for us in this Gospel book of Matthew. We see those people. And what of Jesus? Is Jesus there? You know he is. He's on the cross. How was Jesus recognized before this? He was an exceptional teacher. And there on the cross, he didn't speak a word. He was the wonder worker. There on the cross, he was powerless. What do these things testify of him at that point? Is everything lost? He's doing none of these things. Is he now to be dismissed as an irrelevance? But that's the thing, isn't it? That's where we've reached. Matthew then takes another step in the story. By verse 44, which is where I had reached in our previous studies in Matthew, by verse 44, Jesus was not yet dead. He is portrayed here as a powerless king, described as a king, named as a king, but seemingly without power. He hasn't died yet. Is he powerless? Well, what do you make of this thing? And so we take up at verse 45. Just one moment before we go there. Have you ever thought of God as powerless? Because he seems to be doing nothing. Of course. You never thought that, did you? You believe in God. You believe in all that we say about Him. The Almighty One, the Creator, all of these things. You believe that? No, just hang on a minute. It's about life. It's about behavior. Is there something, some area of life, some time in life, perhaps even in this past week, perhaps even this morning, if you look at that honestly, openly, that's a time when you have behaved as though God is not your Lord, meaning that you are behaving as though God is powerless, that He's not bothered with you, that He doesn't bother with what you're doing. Aren't there times when you have behaved, whatever the words say, whatever you have in your intellectual belief, have you not behaved at times as though He is really unimportant? Put it another way, how vividly conscious are you every moment of the day of the Almighty God, of His presence? I want you to consider that as we come to these things before us today. Against the background of Jesus at the cross, saying nothing, doing nothing, so far, how does this affect your life? And how do these things affect your life when we realize that this is telling us that the Son of God, dead and buried? I want to look first at Jesus, who died and was buried, to notice as we go that it is like us, but not like us at the same time. To see also the response that He is dead and buried, and that is responded to by creation, and also responded to by men. This chapter tells us in 6 verses that Jesus died, and He was buried, tells us after that. Now, I did say a moment ago that this exceptional teacher said nothing on the cross, but from this point He does say a few things. We read one of them here. The other Gospels will tell us of another 6 particular sayings. But these first words, for anyone who knew, they should have sent a shiver down their spine. And if you and I know them today, they should send a shiver down our spine as well. Thinking of who it is who says them. How has Jesus spoken of God throughout the Gospel until this point? When He has prayed to Him, He has said, "My Father." When He has spoken of His commission, He has said, "My Father sent me." But this is a word of forsakenness. "My God." Twice, "My God. Why have you forsaken me?" Suggests, for one thing, that the Psalms were so much part of His spiritual makeup that this was the best way He had of expressing what He was going through at that point. And not just the words that He said, "Oh, these words fit my circumstances," but they carried all the meaning of that psalm that we've just sung. Sense of abandonment by a covenant God in His most severe need. These are the words that come to mind. That, by the way, is a lesson to us all. How well do you know the Psalms? When need arises, would those words come to your mind? They came to Jesus. That tells us that it's worth having, surely. that are forsaken cry. That was a psalmist suffering. One who was chosen by God back way many years ago suffered, and he cried out with a sense that God had left him. There are very deep things here concerning Jesus, but there is a very clear sense of his aloneness there on the cross. His disciples, his closest human friends, had all scattered and left him. Who can he turn to? He can surely turn to God. Who would you turn to if you had a sense that everyone had left you, that no one understood you? You might just turn to God. And what does he say? God, you've forsaken me. I can't even turn to you. That's the sense that he had. And little wonder, he was on a cross. The cross was the death of the curse. He bore the sins of many. And God must turn his eyes away from sin. And that is why he must die. Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. These were words from the Hebrew Psalms. And it would seem that there were Jews around him. People who knew of Elijah. That's who they thought he was talking about. It seems they did not know the Psalms. At least not the ones of suffering. Not the ones of the Messiah suffering. And that's what that psalm is. Jesus used the Psalm of David. The Messiah was to be as David and include the sufferings of David. But that's where they parted ways, Jesus and those around him, the Jews around. To them, no Jewish Messiah would suffer. He was to come in great glory and honor. They didn't see the Messiah, whom they had just heard. Didn't see him for what he was. He had told them already, Elijah has already come. He was speaking of John the Baptist, who had come to be the herald and to come before the coming Messiah. John had done that. These people were way behind schedule. This was an occasion of suffering. They didn't connect it with the Messiah. They were still blind to him. But then we also find, after that, that he cried out again with a loud voice. Doesn't tell us what he cried. Luke 23:46 tells us he cried loudly, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. He is able to call him God, Father again. But this loud cry is a commitment of his spirit, his life, into God's hands. I would suggest this tells us two things. One, that he did this from a position of strength. He wasn't at his last ebb when he could only gasp the words. But he put his strength into it and he cried it out with a loud voice. And second, what did he cry out? He said, I commit my spirit into your hands. It was as though he took that spirit and he gave it to God to care for it. Verse 50 in this chapter tells us that. He yielded up his spirit. Perhaps we should put more contemporary words on this. To commit or to yield is this to give. It means he died. That was his death. He yielded up his spirit. And we see in this chapter he is a man. He is like us in that. That he died. True death. But there are these other points that remind us how different his death was. How unlike our death his was. There was the purpose. It was purposed. It was intended. It was planned. And it was also a purposeful death. It was planned as part of that unique work that he had come to do amongst us. And it was also a deliberate part of his activity. He was active in doing this. He is the one man in all of history who has given his life. When he died, he is the great loving friend who lays down his life. He is an active participant in this. You might say, well, there are others who are active in their own death or in the death of others. But in every case, it is a taking of life. There is something significant there. He can give because it was his to give. Our life is not ours to give. It is always taken from us. Because by our sin we have forfeited that possibility. But we read here that it was his to give, and he gave it. That was his purpose, was to lay down his life for his friends there on the cross. If you were to go over to Mark's Gospel, chapter 15, verse 44, tells us that his death was unexpectedly quick. Pilate, when he was asked for the body, Pilate marveled. He was surprised that Jesus was already dead. It was much shorter than the usual time scale for a crucifixion. And he even summoned the centurion to confirm that he had been dead for some time. It was an unusual thing. It's fully explained here. Because he was active in this, giving his life, giving his spirit into the Father's hands. I'm very much aware that in this passage there are a number of other things that are raised here, but we need to hold them over for another time. But I just emphasize that what is central to this is what Jesus has done for me, for you. He gave his life. We might just try and put other words in it and say he died. Let's emphasize it. He gave his life. Will you hold it? We have communion next week. I'm not preaching a resurrection sermon this morning on what is known as Easter Sunday. Perhaps it's better that we look at this. Prepare us to proclaim the Lord's death at the communion, at the Lord's table. But at that table, many of you will come, sit around that table, take the body and the blood of Christ. When you do that, are you ready to testify to this? What Jesus did there, he said, "This is my body given for you." When we take the bread. But at that table it is no mere formality. But at that table you come with genuine, heartfelt gratitude. That he's given his life for you. If he has worked in you, he makes it possible in another sense that you can give your life to him. But that's the question at that table next week. Will you give your life? That's what it means to proclaim his death. It means that that death is central to all that you are and do. Is it? With a loud voice, he committed his spirit to his Father. That's what that's asking you when you hear it this morning. Let's see how else it is significant. This is no ordinary man that we're talking about. Who is it that gave his life for you? And so there are other things that were active as he died. As he died actively, other things were active. There was creation responding. I put this as a heading. It is rather broad. but it's dealing with the major upheavals, the cosmic upheavals that we've seen in this chapter. And verse 45 begins with it. It's the umbrella, as it were, covering this period. An exceptional darkness. At a time of day you don't expect it. 3 hours. I don't think even the recent, complete eclipse of the sun was for that long. Even if you saw it at the best sight. An exceptional darkness. And I believe Jesus must have felt it. I think that's why Matthew puts it together with the forsaken cry in verses 45 and 46. They're meant to be joined together in our understanding. And do remember, it wasn't all that long before this that there were wise men who came from the east because they had seen a star. This was of a generation and a day when people were very familiar with the skies, with the heavens, with the stars. They were very familiar with any of the normal phenomena that would darken the sky, like eclipses and so on. They could tell when they were coming. They were skilled at that. This was something unusual, unexpected, something fitting for this occasion. A one-off. Because it's unexplainable, it was also agitating to anyone who went through it. There are other things that happened as well. Verses 51 to 53. We read first of all of the veil of the temple. I suspect would suggest that Matthew went to gather the relevant information for this occasion, to tell the story of this occasion. And he finds that the veil of the temple was torn in two. We can easily pass over this, and perhaps you've heard others talking about it, but there are points that we should just mention. It was torn open. And it would most likely be that appears that it was the veil that kept everyone out of the most holy place where God said, "My presence will dwell amongst my people." There was one room at the very back of the temple that was restricted access until except one day every year when the high priest came and offered sacrifice for sin for the people, the Day of Atonement. But this was in Herod's great temple. It was truly great. If you go to the books, you'll read about the dimensions. It was massive. Great height from top to bottom. It was immensely rich. I could go to my house, and we've got some curtains in the house, and they're nothing as rich as these ones in the temple. And I could take those with my hands and try and tear them, and I would not succeed. Even the strongest of you here wouldn't succeed. These curtains were thicker and richer than anything you could imagine. Herod put thousands of money into this building. And the height, I couldn't reach it, nor could Del. This was not a man. It was torn from the top to the bottom. Now, you could well explain it. You know that later on it tells us there was an earthquake. Perhaps that earthquake shook the whole thing and tore it apart. It doesn't tell us that the temple started to collapse. Most likely it would have done if that rich curtain was to be ripped as it was. These were remarkable things. The earthquake itself, even if that does explain it, it happened at that very moment of his death. As he, Jesus, cried out with a loud voice, gave up his spirit, the earth shook. And it wasn't just as though there was an epicenter 100 miles away and you felt the glasses shake on the table. This was an earthquake that split the rocks. The real thing. At the moment he died. Who made that noise? Someone's responsible for these things that happened. I can't go into the bodies raised. We may be able to talk about that next week when we see Jesus risen or in a couple of weeks' time. There were the bodies that were raised as well, alive, raised. It's resurrection. The power that was associated with this man, this death. Surely this is the beginning of the resurrection that he was to bring. He is the one who was the resurrection and the life by virtue of his death, conquering sin and power in the lives of men. So what we see here, we can summarize it as creation's response. Creation responded to the dying of the one, the very one, who brought it into being. Without him was nothing made that was made, Paul tells us. He brought it into being. He brought life about. He was the word that spoke at the beginning that the world should be created. And when he gave his life, creation had something to say about it. Creation trembled at the very thought. And there were people around who saw these things. And they said, these happenings need some explanation. You tell me what's going on. At last some stirred because of him. Some confessed, but some still rejected. We see the soldiers. Previously, they hadn't cared. They had played over his clothes. They had seen this man as nothing. He was dead to them. But when he really did die, what a death! Look at the things that happened around it. No other death we've seen is like this. At the moment of his expiring, the earth shook. And for a man familiar with watching others die on crosses, his death was surely different as well. These were men who had been on duty for hours. They had heard all the scorn that had been thrown at this dying man. They had seen these phenomena. These were straightforward sort of guys, these soldiers. No nonsense. But they had questions. And they bear a testimony that no one else did. They are the ones who say, truly, this was the Son of God. They saw amazing things and they looked for a doer. Why is all this happening? The only thing they can see that else that's going on is that this person died, and in such a way. The earth itself, the skies, all things are disturbed. Only a God could have this effect. Yes, I put it that way because we don't know just how much they understood of this. But that's the way they must have thought. Only a God could have this kind of effect, whatever they understood by a God. But the thing is that Matthew spots it. And Matthew, by the inspiration of the Spirit, says, this is the testimony that God intends us to hear on this occasion. Truly, this was the Son of God. At last, someone makes confession. We could also note, through the rest of the passage that we read, a number of others whose devotion to Jesus is also set out on this occasion. Remember, the closest of his circle have disappeared. Although another gospel tells us John was still nearby. But who's there? Who is there when their master was being under such opposition and affliction? Who is there? It's the women who have ministered to him for many days and many years. They're faithful to the apparent end. There's things that can be brought out of that. Jesus has a high regard for these women. They have a high regard for him. There is an important place in Jesus' heart for women in a way that had never been before anywhere, and so often has been neglected since as well. But there is also Joseph. In verse 57, Joseph with Arimathea, he appears. Matthew has not told us of him before. He is mentioned earlier in some of the other gospel records. But he hasn't appeared before. We're not to think any less of him for that. He appears, if you like, when the need is greatest. He appears when the others are not there. He appears to give what he has to care for this one whom he loves. He uses his wealth and his position to claim that body, to identify with this Jesus, even in his death. And he takes it in his wealth, as he say, well, I can buy this plot and we can bury him there. No, he says, I'm giving him my own, my best, my tomb. At least he warrants that. It's a tremendous example. But with all that, there are some who reject it. Still some who reject it. The same people, even now, they reject it. Even with those things that the soldiers saw and responded to. Look at the ingenuity of these people to concoct a tale that will avoid them acknowledging what is glaringly obvious to anyone willing to see it. Look what they're doing. But it's out of fear, surely. They do speak of his words. Words that they were afraid of coming about. I will rise again. They were afraid. If they'd been really sure of their victory, none of these precautions would have been necessary. If they were afraid. And what do? They don't come looking for answers. They label him with what belongs rightly to themselves. They call him the deceiver. There's a warning there. But in a strange way, there is also one of the most effective testimonies that we have. It comes from his enemies. They say, they know, they are sealing the tomb. They say he is dead and buried. Don't let anyone contradict that. It's Jesus' own enemies who say he was dead, truly dead, and buried. They never expected him to rise, to appear again. As far as they were concerned, the only solution to this thing that he had said was if the disciples found the body and carried it away somewhere else. Still dead. This rings true. His enemies tell us he was dead, he was buried. But I do need to close. I ask you, what now? That must always be the question when you read in Scripture. There is evidence for a start that Jesus did die and he was buried. You need to answer why. The facts are clear, and the Bible gives the reasons why. But are you personally sure of those reasons? Are you personally sure of whom we speak? Who is it who gave his life? It's the one on whom creation depends. The Son of God. That's evidence. The centurion reminds us of that. Do you see this? On that day, Jesus gave his life. Why would he do such a thing? And who receives that life? In the first place, the Father in heaven. But what has the Father in heaven done with that life? And so to speak, we know the next part. He gave him life again. He raised him from the grave. I trust we'll be able to read and meditate on that again shortly. But there is also a sense in which the life that Jesus gave then is to be given out to those who believe in him. There is no other life that will do if you and I are to stand before God. And that's the first thing. Will you stand before God? Or will you cower in fear, in a sense of how hopeless your position is before Him? You need His life that He gave there on the cross through faith in Him and that death. But I also want to say, look at the kind of life he gave to His Father. Look at the kind of life He gave for you, if you are to claim it for yourself. What kind of life was it? This drives the point home so strongly. But it's true of all of His life. What did He come to do? He came to give His life. His life is a self-giving life. That's the very character of it. So contrary to the life of man. Yours and mine too. Except by the work of God's grace in our hearts. If you want this life so that you can stand clean and pure before God, this is the life you will receive, and this is the life, the character of this life that you must live. Self-giving, no less than His was. It needs to transform your days and mine. You have faith to stand before God. That's a faith that must bring cosmic change to you. That compact earth that you have, that world that you live in, that you've made for yourself, is shattered, that quakes because of what He did there. And is made new to live and to give. Jesus said, "No man can be my disciple unless he take up his cross as Jesus did then, daily, and follow me." You want to save your life? Give it to Him. Please do it. Look who died. How can your life ever be yours alone anymore? Can you see what's happened here? May God grant His blessing on each of us as we hear Him this morning. Let us pray together.